Let's see. How many of you believe in astrology? No, no, no. Don't put our hands, okay? It's very embarrassing. Oh. And how many of you have followed your parents to go to the temple and given a bunch of incense and say, burn to this, is good for you, burn to that, that's good for you? I'm quite sure a lot of those of you from Asian backgrounds or come from, especially those in Southeast Asia, right? They've got the habit of doing that. Now, it's not about burning incense, but I'm going to tell you one instance which happened to me, and people surrounding me is like that. Years ago, when I was doing the equivalent of your HSE around here, usually for Buddhist students, when you want to do well in exams, what do? You go to temple and pray, right? And there's a particular belief. You know, in some temples, they have this Bodhi tree. In especially the Thai and the Sri Lankan tradition of Burmese temples, they always have a Bodhi tree. And what we do is we go to the Bodhi tree, and if you want to make a wish, we go and bow in front deeply in front of the Bodhi tree, and then walk a few rounds around it, usually three rounds, three. Right? Not two, not one. Three rounds around it. And after that, we make a wish, right? Make a vow, aspiration, or whatever you call it, it's a wish, to say that, let me pass my exams with flying colors, so that I'll be grateful to you. And when I pass with flying colors, I come with a bottle of milk to feed you. So we bring a bottle of milk, usually pour into the roots there. And then, on top of that, we did something else. That's to, in order to burden the tree, we tie a little bit piece of rock onto a string and tie the string onto the branch. And then after that, they say, okay, if I pass my exams, I come and remove this this little piece of rock. So we are threatening the Bodhi tree. And you know the Bodhi tree is a very sacred tree to the Buddhists, right? To the Buddhists, because the Buddha is supposed to be enlightened under this tree. He sat under this tree and then he got enlightened, and we consider this tree to be extremely sacred. Right? And we threaten the Bodhi tree, you know, sort of blackmail it. And after that, go back and sit my exam. And that year, I happened to pass my exams very well. Then went with a big bottle of milk, then pour around the roots, and then remove the thing. Then bow to the Bodhi tree. Thank you very much, Bodhi tree. Thank you for giving me all these good results. Right? I forgot that I worked very hard for it too. Then it's the custom. Then one particular year, the Bodhi tree nearly died. You know why? We had too many people passed the HSCs very well. Everybody came and took a bottle of milk and just pour around it. And you know, milk is very acidic. Right? And when you pour around it, it ferments and it just sort of changed the pH structure of the soil, and then it nearly killed the tree. So after that, the venerable monk says, from now on, this practice has got to stop. Now this is one of the examples where you can see it's sort of superstition we have around Buddhism. We sort of, this is a very baseless belief. The Buddha has never said that. The Buddha has never said, oh, this is a privileged tree, therefore you must pray to it. But why do we do it then? Why do Buddhists, you know, supposedly intelligent young Buddhist students who are going to be the leader of the country in future, go and pray to a tree and then blackmail the tree, pouring milk to kill the tree, right? And do all these funny things? It's because of superstition. Now you look at superstition, it's just nothing more than irrational beliefs, right? Very baseless belief in things. Of course, some of the superstitions are not so bad, right? It's not serious at all. You know, you just believe in astrology, as long as you're okay, tomorrow I'm going to have bad luck, so I just try to avoid, you know, doing certain things important. It's not so bad. But when you start to believe things affecting our life, using this baseless belief on our life, then it can be very serious. You find that in other religions it's the same thing. Then they start to get really, you know, superstitious and lose all their way of thinking. They go around killing people, killing their own sons as well. There's a case not long ago in up where I live in Brockham Hills. This mother thought that the son is a Satan or devil. And they killed her son. Right? So So that sort of belief is getting very serious. Now, if you go around different countries in Asia, especially, you'll find that there's a lot of superstitious practice being practiced by Buddhists. I got a friend who's never been exposed to Buddhism in this country. So whatever he learned, we tell him about what Buddhism is all about. And when he went to Thailand, he came back, he says, "Jim, the Buddhism I see in Thailand is completely different from the Buddhism you talk about." So why is all this different? Basically, we can say that there could be some differences between Buddhism and what the Buddha taught. So when you say what the Buddha taught, you've got to go back to early days. According to history, according to the documents and all these things, according to scripture, we can roughly have an idea about what the Buddha taught. And what the Buddha taught, I more or less mentioned it 2 weeks ago. This mind control and all these things. But if you look at the popular way which Buddhism is being taught, they neglect all this altogether. There are a lot of times when people teach things other than what a Buddha has taught. But the reason why this happened is quite simple. It goes from one period to another. That is the difference in time, the difference in the place, because it moved from one country to another. And everybody put in their own input. And those input usually are not really good, because they put in their beliefs in, they put in their whatever inside there. So when we go back to life of Buddha, Buddha started life he was born as a normal human being, as a baby. But then you look at it in the stories, right, if you're familiar with the Buddha stories, when he was born, what happened? All the traditions will tell you that when the baby Buddha was born, he walked 7 steps, and every step he's got a lotus. And after he pointed and say, up there and down here, I'm the greatest. Right? Sounds like that guy called Muhammad Ali, he called himself the greatest. So, but do you think that can happen or not? So, that's where those superstitions start. It starts from these legends, stories. And then, instead of going into the Buddha's teachings, we will go into that sort of thing. Buddha started as a human baby. He ended up as a young man. He ended up getting enlightened. And then for another 45 years, he was a monk. And then after that, he died as a human being. He died the same way as human being died. But unfortunately, later stage, people start to want to have something more. So they make the Buddha, instead of as a human being, they make the Buddha into a transcendental being. Right? If some of the Chinese Buddhist books will tell you that the Buddha actually is not a person on earth. It's just an image transferred by some other Buddhas to come and teach us all those good things. Now, of course, that's a belief. Right? Nobody can prove to you. No science can prove to you that. But what history says that he was born as a person. He was born as Siddhartha Gautama. And then, of the tribe Sakya, a warrior tribe. His father was a ruler. He grew up in a very good way. You know, a good young man as a warrior. He has trained in various ways. He's intelligent and all this. Of course, that is, it's like you and me. We are intelligent. We are good looking. We are everything. Then, after that, he got married. And then he's not happy with life as a whole. Got some problems, and he start to have questions. So he start to try to get an answer or answers to his doubts in his mind. His doubts mainly to tell why should we live, why should we die. And eventually, when nobody could give him the answer, he left home and tried to find out more from holy people around him. So he joined these different groups. And in India during that time, there were very, very, a lot of different kinds of practices. Some people will sit down and meditate in the hope that, you know, through the meditation they find the truth. Some will say, okay, you know, I believe that if you if you torture yourself, then you might find the truth. It's a very, very funny way of thinking. Human beings are very funny. So he did the meditation, but he found that this couldn't work. And then after that, he did going to go hungry, faster. He did all sorts of things which is encouraged by different teachers at the time. He failed very badly, nearly died. Then after that, he decided to nurse himself back to health. And then after that, he was living alone. And finally, one night, he just sat under a tree. And the tree is reputed that to be that Bodhi tree. You know? So sat under a tree, and then because of all his practices, the way he can calm his mind and all these things, all of a sudden the mind has come to a certain stage where he could really see that all these things are all just, life is just a process. Nothing more than a process. Process of growing old, process of the mind changing all the time, process of having one emotional state after another, and it's because of all these things combined together, therefore we get in the state of suffering, or unsatisfactoriness, or anguish, or whatever you call it. And on the second night, he found that that's the whole cause of it. The cause, because of our mind working, the grasping mind of ours. So he goes on, and he starts to say, okay, that's the way. If we can control this grasping mind of ours, we can let go of this clinging or attachment of ours completely, then there should be no stress in your life. And then after that, he spent the next 45 years trying to give his teaching to other people. He didn't push his teachings, but he just tell people, whoever wanted to know, to learn from him, he taught. And that's basically what it's like. And what he taught, something to do with what is nature, or what is the characteristics of existence. Right? Things are impermanent. The thing is, you are not what you think you are. And then, it's because of this process of living, therefore we get into all sorts of stress, all sorts of problems. Now, after that, he died. He died as a human being. A lot of Buddhists don't want me to say, use the word die on Buddha, because the Buddha never died. What did he do? What is the word they use? He entered what? Paranibbana. Of course, no. If I use die, D-I-E, I save a lot of ink and a lot of paper. If I use Paranibbana, it's a bit longer. So in other words, the Buddha died. Died as a human being. Body. But his mind is not a human mind. What is a human mind? The human mind is something which is always go and grip and grab and grasp. A non-human mind is one which is free of this gripping, grabbing and grasping. So, when somebody asks the Buddha, are you a human being? He says, no, I'm not a human being. The reason is, although he's got a human body, he doesn't have a human mind. Then he says, are you a god? He says, no, I'm not God either, because he's not a god apparently. Right? So, the Buddha didn't tell a lie when he said that he's not a human being, neither is he a god. But because of this question, people start to conjure up things. Like, okay, after his death, if you are not a human being, if you are not a god, then you must be something which is greater than God. Right? I mean, this human logic, if you are not this, you are not this, then probably you must be this. So what happened after the Buddha died is very interesting, because he had got a big following. In fact, he was singularly the most popular of all the religious teachers during his time. There are six other competitors, but they all fizzle out one after another. So he's got a big following, and his influence is on quite a big area, you consider that time, during that time. It's something like 200 or 300 mile radius around the northeastern part of India. It's quite a big place. And because of that, his reputation was great. So when he died, a lot of those warriors and kings and all these things come and demand part of his remains. The remains is the cremated remains. Because he died and they cremated him. And those days, the cremation is not complete. Some parts are burned better than others. So you find that there are pieces of hair not burned, pieces of fingers and nails and teeth and all these things. So they nearly fought over that thing until one wise Brahmin said, why should we fight over this this guy's thing. Why not we divide it up? So they divided the thing, and then they took the thing back to their own country, and they make a monument out of it. And those monuments are not like the monuments you have, not the Buddha image. Primitive monuments are just nothing more than a mound of earth covering it. And that becomes a place of pilgrimage. So throughout the years, as it develops, his disciples started to follow, those who follow his teachings would preach whatever the Buddha has taught. But those who do not want to follow him will start to add whatever they think is relevant. Start adding a little bit of things there. And then eventually, and also there'll definitely be some entrepreneurs around, you know, clever people. People who make money out of religion. Can you think of anybody who make money out of religion in this country? They do. So it's easy, because that mound, which they put the relic of the Buddha or the bones of the Buddha, can become a place of pilgrimage. And what happens when you have a pilgrimage? I become the caretaker, you come there, okay, this thing, you pay me a few donations. So I skim off the money, I get rich. So, but if I keep saying that Buddha is a human being, then I make no money. So I start to make stories out of it. Stories and stories. And possibly that's how the legend of Buddha developed. But during his time, he always go back to the fact that he started off as a human being. And as the time goes on, you find that he's elevated to the status of God, given the status of a God or Deva. Then after that, he becomes greater, because teachers of Devas, or the teachers of the gods, and so on. So, from there, more and more stories develop. And eventually, the ones he handed down is so varied. Yeah, there's only one more on Buddha. But somewhere in the development, as we go down the track, the Buddhists will have to come into contact with other religions as well. Right? And in India, there's the traditional Indian religion and Buddhism develop almost at the same time. Right? And then you find that as the traditional Indian religion develops, the status of gods and so on became very important. Right? We have a lot of divisions that start to become really extremely polytheistic, too many, so many gods. And somehow, some Buddhists will have to put in a lot of things too. Otherwise, you can't compete with them. So what happens is they start to have all this, other than Buddha, other things. And they call them the Bodhisattvas. So the Bodhisattvas is the Buddhist answer to the Indian gods. So if I have one Bodhisattva and do this, the other Bodhisattva is this, the other Bodhisattva is this. And then we started with five or six Bodhisattvas, great Bodhisattvas, and then eventually we get thousands of Bodhisattvas. We got millions of Bodhisattvas. As many as the sands in the river Ganges. And when you start to have that, then that belief system is complete. With every Bodhisattva, there's a story. Then the worst thing is when he goes to Tibet, there's the original animistic religion in Tibet, where they believe in all these fierce spirits and all this. You find that some of the Bodhisattvas became extremely fierce too. You look at the Tibetan icon, some of them got these people hanging, dangling from the mouth. I mean, they can say, okay, it's just an icon, just something which, you know, we present graphically, but still, it's the origin of it comes from the local religion. And what happens when he goes to China, or he went to China? I mean, most of you are coming from, a lot of you come from a background you should know. You go to every Chinese temple in Indonesia or Malaysia or where, you can see what happens. There's so many things from one to another to another. You got not only the Buddhist thing, but you also add in a lot of those Chinese icons. How many have prayed to this little stone tiger before? So, a lot of times we tend to link to things. Now, this Jade Emperor business, it's not even Taoist, it's something to do with the traditional Chinese thing. And what happened was, in the Buddhist stories, there are also reference to the 31 heavens, right? And 31 heavens, you know, you get, and one of those heavens, I don't remember which one, was the realm of Sakya. Right? Then they link this Sakya or Sakya to the Jade Emperor. And nowadays with modern Buddhists, they try to link this Sakya or Sakya to God. So it's just through this compromising that we get all sorts of belief. And are these beliefs really good for Buddhism or not? Of course, depends on it, how you look at it. It's good, very good for the Buddhist business. If you take it as a business, it's very good. The more Buddhas you pray to, the more money the businessman makes. Right? But if you look at it, for our own practice, it's actually great hindrance. It just blocks our practice. It's because when you start to believe, and you find that belief is based on attachment. If there's no attachment, there's no belief. The other one is, belief is the opposite of wisdom. If you want to realize the truth or know the truth, then you've got to get rid of belief. Because truth can never be believed. Truth is knowledge and truth is wisdom. From the knowledge you practice, you develop the wisdom, therefore it becomes the truth. So nobody can come and con you about the truth. But a lot of people can con us on beliefs. Because after all, belief is something which depends on my power of convincing you. If I tell you that this, I can make this teacup fly, raise this teacup. If I talk a lot and just hypnotize you, you can actually see the teacup rise by a few inches from the table, right? So all these things depends on how I convince, how the person convinces others. Right? So in this way, you find that these sort of things also crept into Buddhism. Right? They convince you that you can see all these things. And then they convince you that this is bad, that is bad, this is good, that's good. Right? And if you look at the Buddha's teachings, he doesn't talk about good and bad. He just talks only about skillful and unskillful. Right? And again, I want to tell you this story. How many of you have bathed little Buddha before, during Buddha's birthday? Right? I think most of you have, right? Now, when I was brought up to bathe Buddha, it's a nice thing to do. It's a very nice ritual. When I was young, we used to have this thing in the temple, and all these old ladies would stand in two rows, and then they'd be chanting. Those days, we don't have any cassette tapes or anything, so the whole day they take turns, you know, four on both sides, and then they chant. Right? They chant the Tai Chi and all these things. So we'll go there and then just take our water from the thing and then just pour on the Buddha. Usually I pour on the head. Right? So that's the way we do. And then after years of coming here, I never poured any water on the Buddha's head. I never baked Buddha because we don't have that sort of things here. Until one year they had it in Darling Harbour. So for time for me to teach my daughter about our customs and traditions. So I took her to the thing. And then it's a long queue, we queue up. So I queue up my turn, I put my donation there and then the thing. And put on the Buddha's head. When you bathe, you always bathe on the head, right? And this lady who is attending the place and taking my money nearly died. No, you don't do that. Pour it on the finger. So I think, I don't know where she got these things from, right? So after that, you do your thing, I do mine. Yeah, I think she was looking up there to see whether the lightning would come and strike me or not. So you can see, this superstition brings a lot of fear into people. Right? Now, this is laughable thing, but you look at how a lot of superstitious belief in Buddhism actually do put fear into people. Have you been put fear on this? Yeah. I would say, I don't know, but the thing is, when people believe, it tends to be on the fearful side. Yeah, that's right. What the Buddha You can look at the teachings of Buddha. Now, you have seen that Buddha image with that, right? The cow, that is the mudra to dispel fear. Because the Buddha teaches not to be fearful. Right? And the only thing we can remove fear is through wisdom. Right? You look at belief is the other end of wisdom. When you're wise, you don't believe. When you know, you don't believe anymore. A good trick of mine was I put my hand in the bank and say, okay, I got that $1 here. But you believe in or not? So usually we believe or not believe. But the Buddhist way is open up and see. Right? So that is what the Buddha says, open up and see. And that we make into a sort of a metaphor about developing the third eye. Right? One eye see, one eye don't see. So the other eye can see clearly. So the third eye became the wisdom eye. And then after that, what happens? Some meditation, you sit down there, you want to open this wisdom eye. So it becomes, well, from this sort of metaphor becomes a belief, and the belief becomes something which we practice to get. When you look at the Buddha's teachings, he's trying to make us dispel fear, because fear is singularly the thing which causes all the stress and suffering which we have. And once we get rid of fear, then things becomes clearer. So what do we actually fear? Right? For human beings, the fear is the fear of the unknown. But the thing is, can the unknown be known or not? If it can be known, then it won't be known as the unknown. So, all the time we are trying to chase things which we cannot find an answer to. But we are neglecting the things which we can look into to get an answer out of. Right? Now, that is why the Buddha taught us. He tells you, go and look at the things which you can understand. Look at the things which will give you the answer, rather than try to look for an answer to the unanswerable thing. But unfortunately, human mind is such, we want to know the unknowable. Right? You keep on asking why? Why this? And always when you come to that stage, there's no answer to this why. And we still want to do it, then what happens? We fall into belief. If I ask me, why am I born? Because of past karma. Why past karma? Because of the previous karma. Why the previous karma? Because of that. There's no answer. So if we just put our ears out and listen closer to what the Buddha taught. He never passes this why beyond the first one or two whys. He tells you, you are in this situation. What are you going to do about it? What's next? So, it becomes a very, very simple way of doing things. Like for example, I say touch the nose. Most of us touch this way. But there are people who are clever people who want to touch us, but the other way. Can we do it or not? And we are always looking for the complicated answers. We are always using the complicated route to find the easiest thing. So, you look at it, then in the case, what did the Buddha teach? Simple. If I put it, you know, you can put it in a nutshell to say, get rid of attachment. Because the attachment is something which is bringing problems into you. Now, a lot of people do not want to believe that. When they say, the first noble truth is suffering, everybody agrees, I've got this, I've got that. Right? But it's the problem with the second noble truth, that we do not practice Buddhism properly. Right? The second noble truth is, it starts from me. Right? But a lot of us, we prefer to say, no, it comes from other sources. Somebody says that every time something happens, it's because of bad luck. We believe in luck. We live in other people's faults. Right? All these things. So, that belief itself causes not to be able to see the second noble truth. We say, okay, a lot of times, you know, we find that it's because of some spirits working on me. If you fall sick, a lot of people say it's because of the spirits. Right? Or you don't succeed in your life, it's because of some gods which have you offended and so on and so forth. So we do not want to know the truth. So what we do is, if we really want to follow, we got to look into the second noble truth. When you look at the second noble truth of how this truth come, how this suffering comes in, then there's no need to believe. You know for yourself. The things which we talk about, the material and everything, actually comes from we ourselves. So, in the case, we got to, if I want to talk to you about superstition in Buddhism, there'll be no end of it. Right? You go to any corner in Southeast Asia, you see that. In among the Chinese, we have it. Among the Koreans, we have it. In Japanese, we have it. Among the Thais, we have it. Some more, some less. Right? And when you start to lessen Buddhism into the so-called the earlier teachings of the Buddha, or the teachings near the Buddha's time, a lot of people say, no, we just can't accept that. Because, that's why I said before, this belief and this superstition becomes a hindrance. Right? Now, what the Buddha taught us is actually very simple. The thing is, what is realization? What do you want out of life? We've got to be fair with ourselves to see, you know, what do you want with our life? For most of you, why do you study? Okay, assuming that the realization is study, you've got to go back. What makes you have the intention to want to study? Okay, I want to get this. So, when you have the intention, and between the intention and the realization, what is the linking? What is the link? Supposing you want to become a pharmacist, right? Your idea is to become a pharmacist, and eventually you say, in 6 years' time, I will become a pharmacist. Do you then go and enroll in a horticultural course? That is the thing, right? You got to do the right thing. So when you become a pharmacist, we enroll in the pharmacist course. That's the first part of it. Right? The second part of it, what do we do after that? Follow the course properly. Right? It's no point going do all the other electives except to do pharmacy. Right? So, again, and then put in our effort and so on. So within that, you can see the linking point between our intention and the realization is our input. And the input is work. The input is practice. Right? But when you look at the superstitious part of it, that practice is based solely on devotion. Right? We go in. Do our prayers, and eventually we can realize the thing. But did the Buddha taught that or not? And the Buddha says, you want to do it, you jolly well work on your own self. When you work on your own self, you get a lot better. Right, so let's go back again to where the practice starts. Now, 2 weeks ago we talked about this mind and body. Okay? So it's that mind and that body. Whose mind and whose body? It's this mind and this body. It's that mind and that body. We are all the same in that aspect. We might be a different person, but basically we operate in the same way. So we got to use the time to and the effort to develop this mind of ours. Because the mind conditions the body and the body conditions the mind. We do not have to teach people how to condition the body because everybody knows it. Whereas the mind is something which is very elusive, you have got to really have a proper understanding of it. And once you start to understand the mind, then we can start to work on it. And when we start working on it, we can find that a lot of things which the Buddha taught us is really makes sense, makes more sense, and then we can start to do something about it. Now, when we in the initial stage, when we talk to a lot of people about Buddhism, we talk about this attachment. They realize that they've got plenty of attachment. But when we say, okay, get rid of attachment, most, 99% of them will say, it's very, very difficult, or I can't. But what am I going to do without attachment? What am I going to do without emotions? People have got that sort of speculative way of looking at things. And then we say, okay, it's not for me then. Whereas if you start to develop the understanding, then we can say, okay, that how to make it work. We know that. But it's just because we do not put in the effort, therefore we cannot get the results. Right? So when we start to go back, we can see that practice or the input which you are putting in. The input which you are putting in is very simple. Get some time and some effort. That's all you need. So when you look at, I just put on this one, when they talk about this input, it means three things according to the Buddhist teachings. Right? One is into our knowledge, the other one is our conduct, and the other one is the input is on our mind. Basically three of this. But I can put it in another way by saying that it's wisdom and ethics and mental culture. So you look at it, what are these three? These three is the different part. So when you look at the teachings of Buddha, it's centered all focused on this eightfold path. And then you might ask me, you know, where karma comes from. Karma actually comes from all these three combined. Right? But mainly it starts with the mind. This karma is the way we develop this intention of doing something, the way which we conduct ourselves. Right? It's the way we conduct ourselves is karma, the way karma starts is from the mind. So with this knowledge, it's not ordinary knowledge. Right? It's not something which we just read or hear. It's something more than that. This knowledge comes from our actual experience of it. Right? When you talk about anger, it's no point talking about other people's anger. When you talk about other people's anger, it's just knowledge. It's just what you hear, what you see, and so on. When you talk about our own anger and know that our own anger, then that is wisdom. And where does this all start? You can say you've got to start with the mind. As we talk about mind and the body. It's the knowledge is mind and body brings into contact, and then the contact you get into this attachment, and from attachment we get into the state of suffering. Right? Suffering means, you know, like what you call dukkha. And in order to get into that state, we got to have a good understanding of the six sense bases and the five aggregates. Now the six sense bases can be compared to the ingredients. Right? It's something which allows things to happen. Right? And the five aggregates are the process of things happening. It's from through all these six sense bases that we receive signals from outside. And the signals from outside will eventually make us go into this state of attachment. When you get attached to certain things, then when you attach naturally, straight away, when you get attachment, what happens? You get unsatisfactoriness in it. You may have all your things fulfilled, but eventually you will find that I don't have enough of it. A lot of people will say, oh, I'm working very hard for happiness. But when the person is happy, where was he the next moment? Just imagine, just go back to this last time when you were happy. If happiness can really last, what happened? Straight after your happiness, you find that there will be things which you want some more. Or you're so scared that the happiness will go away, so the mood goes down. So in the practice of Buddhism, it's not all about happiness. It's about understanding this. Now, in order to do all, to get all these things, we have got a certain way of doing it. And the Buddha has given us the blueprint or the plan for doing it. And in many parts of the scripture, you can find that Buddha talks about it, just be aware of the mind. And the teaching is to be able to understand this working. Know that we receive signals from outside, from what we see, we hear, and so on. And because of the understanding of the things, perception and volition and all this thing coming up, therefore we start to develop attachment. So is there anybody disagreeing with all these teachings? Now, when we ask a person to have the right conduct, you know, when we live as a community, we have got to develop some respect for other people. We are not living alone. Right? Even when we live alone, if we don't respect our own selves, if we abuse our own self, what happens? Right? We are not going to have a good life. Right? But when we live with other people, there are more to consider. We've got to consider ourselves, we've got to consider other people. Right? And sometimes put too much attention to ourselves and not to worry about other people, there are going to be problems. People are not going to like it. And then, so the Buddha did emphasize on this conduct to other people. Right? It's how we live with other people. And that's why we have got these five precepts of not killing and so on. Right? It's because when we start to do that, we start to develop certain respect for other people. If you want to live, then we don't take away other people's life. If we want to keep our property, then we don't go and take other people's property. If we respect the truth from other people, then we should not speak untruth. Right? And if we respect wisdom, then we should try to avoid things which cause the cloudiness of the mind. Right? So these are the basic things which basically makes a community live harmoniously. But on top of that, there are many other things which we should practice too. Now, one of the things which we should practice will be kindness. The kindness is not the kindness when apparent kindness that should be shown. There's one teaching which the Buddha asked one of his disciples, how do you practice your kindness? He said, there are three ways I do. I practice kindness of my mind, of in my intention and thoughts. I practice kindness in my words, and I practice kindness in my bodily action. And the Buddha asked him, how did you do that? And he says, well, when we live together, those who goes out and they come back early, we'll prepare our seats, right, regardless. Then we prepare, get the food set together, and then if there's anything which needs to tidy up, we'll tidy up. And then after we have sat down and shared our food, then somebody who leaves last will clean up the place, make the place tidy again. That's a very simple thing which the Buddha has put as an example. And the other one about kindness to other people is shown by the Buddha himself. Because during his time, a lot of people are quite selfish, and there's one particular monk who fell sick with diarrhea. And when the Buddha saw it, he asked the monk, he says, why are you in this state? The monk told him, no, everybody is so busy, they do their own business that they don't have time to care for me. So the Buddha told Ananda, his attendant, he says, go and fetch me some water. And with his own hands, the Buddha cleaned the person. You know how bad it is with diarrhea. And you know how great the Buddha is. You know, he's the person whom kings respect and all these things. And yet, he's there to wash away all these feces of this sick monk. Right? And after that, he makes a rule to these people. He says, you must try to be kind to other monks by attending to the sickness. So that sort of conduct section, you can see in many, many instances quoted in the scripture. It's either done by the Buddha or the Buddha has approved other people of doing it. And the other section is when he found that there's a person who is very successful in teaching other people. He says, why are you so successful in having this great following? Then he said, it's simple. I try to be generous to them. I try to treat them like my equal. I try to work with them, and I try to give them kind words. These are their four things. Right? So, for the precepts, the kindness, compassion, the joy, People are happy, we are happy with them and all these things, together with the other things like having patience with people, having energy to work with other people, then we develop this sort of things. And that's a development, how we develop our conduct. And what about this mental culture? You all should know very well, through all these talks on meditation and so on. Now, when you talk about meditation, it's not solely to sit down there and close your eyes and expect to see things, having these bright lights coming in, or myself afloat in air and so on. These are all gimmicks. Right? The actual idea, what the Buddha wants us to do meditation, is to develop this understanding of the mind. Right? And from the understanding of this mind, how this mind works, we can understand how we go and do our grasping. When you look at the, he advises to go into body feelings, mental states and so on. And it's through this body that we start to develop feelings, and from feelings we start to develop emotions and the various mental states. And from there, we can see there's a lot of things which we manifest in our behavior, our anger, our cravings, our laziness, our restlessness and our doubts. So when you start to look at that, these are the sort of things which the Buddha has taught. But the Buddha did not teach us to burn incense in front of his image. Now, how does it come into being? Again, it depends very much on where those people are. There are, in fact, the burning of this incense is spread by Buddhists throughout the world. But how does it come about? Again, look at the culture of India during the time. A couple of hundred years after, 300 or 400 years after the death of the Buddha, people want to value this sort of things. So the first incense they use is not actually the burning incense. They just grind all the sandalwood and so on and put on the Buddha images. And after that, again, the incense is... Somebody invented the theory that burning incense would take away bad smell. So it covers up all this bad smell. And after that, again, develop this incense will bring our spirits together and so on and so forth. Right? So it becomes a condition that you've got to burn incense when you go to temple. But now if you look at it, this burning of candles, again, what's burning of candles? All Buddhists burn candles, don't they? There's yellow candles, red candles, white candles. And if you burn a white candle in a Chinese temple, you'll be shoot out of the temple. The reason being that white is a color of death or mourning in among the Chinese. So anyway, the burning of candles is actually done for light. Some of them live in caves, and some when they need meat at night, you can't simply see. So they start to burn fire. And then when they invented and when they have candles coming in, then they start to burn candles so that they can see. And then after they become something which you've got to give as an offering. Then there are many, many other things. Like offering food to the Buddha. Water, flowers and so on. If you look at some of the devotional books, they got every time you offer something, there's something you've got to say in Pali. And why do we do that? Now, the reason when they started doing that is because they want to show some respect to the Buddha. So they do it. And after that, it becomes something which is very important. So you find that the rituals that eventually become more important than all these other things. You don't worry about being respect anymore. It's not the respect of Buddha, but you do this because you can get something. So, towards the end, when it comes to us, what happens? You offer a $10 flower is more important than offering a $5 flower. I went to a temple once. Usually, when we go to temples, my family is such, we don't really burn incense. Just go there and just bow to the image and then after that, we give some money to donation. So one day I went, my mom came and I just brought her to one of the temples, and she did the same thing. And then I had this beautiful voice behind me. It says, "Ah, would you like your mother to gain more merits?" But all this merits. Now, I'll talk more about merits later. But if you want your mother to gain merits, come and buy her a flower. So I look at a flower. It's a marigold. You know what marigold is like? Marigold is something which, you know, is so cheap, right? And then I say, "How much is this marigold?" $5. So if I buy $5, my mother will get a marriage. So, again, you know, we are so busy in believing in this marriage. Now, this marriage is not, it's really sometimes getting too deep into the Buddhist belief. We spend a lot of our time making merits. Now, originally, making merits is only, there's only one way of making merits. When you do something wholesome to yourself, do something good to ourselves, that is the time when we really get the merits. Supposing at the moment when I can clear my mind of evil thoughts, right? If I clear my mind of evil thoughts, what happens? I feel a lot better. Because when my mind is full of evil thoughts, what happens? I'm suffering. When my mind is clear of evil thoughts, then I feel a lot better, relaxed. Right? So that relaxation is actually the merits. So when you talk about merits in Buddhism, if you look into merits this way, then it is rational, it's right. When you feel like doing harm to somebody, then all of a sudden you might develop mindfulness and intention of bringing harm to somebody just disappears and you're replaced with calmness, then at the time you are actually savoring the merits. But it became slowly corrupted into religious belief. So you want to get merits, what happens? Do something. Like give money away, give food away and so on. And then that merit making sometimes is being confused with the word dana. Dana in Buddhism means gift or generosity. Now, it's a show of gift or generosity. Now this gift or generosity is very important in the practice, because when we start to give away things, what actually are we really giving? If we give without wanting something in return, right? It's called unconditional gift. Then at that moment, what happens is we are actually giving away our greed. We got plenty of greed, we hold on to a lot of things. When we start to give away some of this, then at the time the mind is temporarily clear about this attachment to this sort of thing, this thing. Right? And then if we can start to give away our time, our service, our efforts and so on, then we find that we get more and more satisfaction out of it. That satisfaction is not something which builds up the ego. That satisfaction is something which you feel happy about it, you feel the joy coming in. Right? So we go back to the four, what we call the four Brahma Viharas, or the four immeasurables. Right? Kind to people. And you're kind to people without any conditions. Kind to anybody without any conditions. Then at the time when you're kind, there's no stress in you. And that is the merit you get. But unfortunately, a lot of people can't understand this concept, so the teaching goes, if you're kind to somebody, you're going to get some merits. And the merits may not be now, the merits will be later on. Of course, later on is true too, if you use it properly. Supposing you are kind to somebody in a good way, then when we think about it, every now and then the thought comes back to us. What happens in the mind? The mind will be free of stress, you feel happy, you feel the joy. So that is merit itself. We are being given by it. But eventually those merit system became corrupted, and they were telling you that, okay, you give, then next life you get more. But you get all these things towards the end of your life and so on. It's no longer something which we get back in the present moment. A monk once told me, he says, when we do good karma, there are three stages of it. You get good karma, because according to the teachings, good karma gives us good results. Right? It gives us the benefit of it. So at the time when you're thinking of it in the past, when you think of it, thinking of doing the good karma, you already get the benefit of being happy, having the joy. When you are doing it at the present moment, you have the joy. And later on, the joy comes, it could be endless, because every now and then when you've got a memory of it, think about it, you get a joy. So this merit making is this sort of things, rather than wanting to have something back. It's no longer that I give you one bowl of laksa and next week I expect one plate of spaghetti from you. It's no longer that. What, again, when you talk about superstition, most Buddhists believe it differently. Why do people donate to temples? What is the mindset behind the donation to temple? I know of one guy who donated a lot of money to the temple, hoping that his five children will eventually become MBBS, and hopefully two of them will become specialists. So we are actually buying this thing, using our donation, using this so-called gift of wanting something back. Well, that wanting something back, we have already done it very often. Think of last Christmas or last whatever holidays you have when you give gifts. What happened? You know, say, like here, it's very common Christmas. Right? You always give things to people on Christmas. Yeah. It's not just giving, just like that. You give because of something. There's always, you want something back. So when, for those people who have got a boyfriend or girlfriend, and they give gifts to the boyfriend or girlfriend, what is the consideration? Okay? You want something. So there's attachment to all these gifts that you give. And because of this attachment, sometimes when you do it, and very often we do it, when you give it, you always have got that fear behind it. What happens if I don't give it correctly? What happens if this thing is, he doesn't like it or she doesn't like it? So you look at it this way, then eventually, if you start to go into the Buddha's way, if you feel like giving, you are generous today, you can give. Whether I give a dollar, I give $10, doesn't matter. Okay. But what we are doing now is, if I like you, I give you more. If I don't like you so much, I give you less. And sometimes the giving becomes something even more than that. And one extreme case I've seen is really awful. This particular woman loves her husband very much. You know. I know her very well. I know the family very well. But the husband has got a really great dislike for green. Anything green. He doesn't even go outside to look at his plants because he doesn't like green color. And then his wife loves him very much. But he thinks that the husband is stupid. Not liking green is a terrible thing. So she wants to change him. So every Christmas and every birthday, he'll get something green for his birthday. Not Christmas. So he got a green handkerchief, green shirt, green trousers and all this. And the last line I heard was, she wrote, she sent an order to Italy. Nowadays you can go by email, and but last those days you got to send by letters. So he went to Italy to order a pair of green shoes for the husband. So, you see, you know, this sort of giving, it's lost the, it doesn't go according to the Buddha statement. And what happens is, when she wants to give it, she's got a lot of all this anger coming out in her. And when you give to the poor husband of hers, there's a lot of anger coming from him as well. So the intention supposedly is supposed to be good, but the outcome is really very bad. So when you talk about this giving, you've got to look into this sort of thing. And we talk about this generosity, it's like that too. When you are generous, what do we mean by that? And once we start to develop some idea about what's happening in our mind, again, go back to the mind training, go back to the mental culture and all these things, be able to see all these things coming up. And from there, you can start to do something about it. And if you talk about Buddha's teaching, is do something about it to yourself, for yourself. It's not expecting the Buddha to do things for us. When you want to study for exam, when you want to finish your course, you can't simply say, I go and just pray and hope to pass. Maybe you might pray and work very hard and you might pass. But if you say, no, I just want to pray and hope that I'll pass, it can never happen. If you want to say, assuming that you want to study Greek, Anybody you study Greek here? No. Who know Greek here? No? Ah, okay. So yeah, you are exception. Now, supposing you want to say, I want to go and get a degree in Greek. What should I do? Enroll myself in a course, alright? Then after that, study very hard, and then sit for the exam and pass it. But if I were to do like a lot of people do, I want to get a degree in Greek, I enroll for it, but I go to a church or temple and pray every day, do you think I'm going to pass my Greek exam or not? Now this might seem ridiculous, but a lot of people are doing that. When somebody suffers, somebody is in the state of anger and all these things, having crisis at home and so on, what do? They go and pray. Go to a temple to pray, go to a church to pray, talk to the priest, talk to the monks and all these things, and accept the whole thing to happen. It can never happen. It's only through understanding how we get all these disputes and all these things. And the best thing to do is before we get all these problems. So before we get these problems, we prepare ourselves. That's why we go and tell people, go to do your meditation, go and learn to train your mind. So that when we come to face with problems, at least our training will contribute to our well-being. Now there's a case where a long time ago when I first tried to teach meditation, and there's a couple who is very interested in Buddhism, but again, they're not interested in doing the hard job. Right? So they say, oh Jim, you're teaching meditation. I want to learn some meditation. So we went there, and every time we're going to go there, we gossip more than we do meditation. We meditate for 5 minutes, but gossip for 1 hour. And then also, later on I found out every time I do meditation, the husband will drink a lot of wine so that he sleeps during meditation. So they virtually learn very little about it. Then, finally I got to give up. I said, no more teaching meditation, because that won't work. They know about it, it's a new age thing to them, right? And they don't want to put in the effort, don't want to put in all this energy to do it. So I stopped it. Then one fine day I got a phone call in the morning, 7:30, I got it from the husband. He says, guess what, Jim? I'm now in the doghouse. My wife has just kicked me out, right? And they're going in for a divorce. Can you come and teach me meditation? And then 10 o'clock, the wife rang me. He says, guess what? There's something wrong with our marriage, and we are going to go into divorce, and can you come and teach me meditation? So we are actually doing the things in a upside down manner. When we are healthy, when we are in good mind and so on, we do not want to place any importance into training the mind. It's only when we start to have problems and we say, okay, let's do something. But now, it's because of this mentality. Therefore, some clever people will capitalize on that. So, okay, you never want to train for your mental culture and all this, you cannot do anything with your mind. So when you're in trouble, what happens? For a small fee, I can pray for you, right? And I can get rid of the problem. Right? So these are the sort of things which is happening in this world. Asking people to do the wrong thing. Right? When you are itchy in the face, do you scratch your bum to get rid of the itch in the face? So you got to see, the right time to do is when we are actually healthy, right? When we are actually are in control of our senses, right? When we have got some free time, we put our free time into doing all these things. Otherwise, when it comes to all this crisis, then what happens? Come pray with me, I pray for you and all these things. Right? It's not the Christians only doing it, but it's everybody. I know a lot of Buddhists who do that too. Somebody dies, they cannot handle the thing, so what they do? Send metta. Send the loving kindness. They come in at night and chanting and all these things in the hope that the dead person will go to a better rebirth. Right? That is another superstition which they believe in. How can you chant so that the person can go to a better rebirth? If the Buddha's teaching is right, we go in with our own karma, the next rebirth. And even that belief in rebirth itself, like that, is also a belief. So, when we have this belief, a lot of other things can come in, the rituals and all things, funeral rites, and so on. Now, if we want to get rid of this belief, what do we do? Just focus on this present life. And focus on what is happening in our mind now. But if you are not able to do it, there is a way of doing it. So when we start to do all these things, you find that slowly we get rid of our superstition one by one. The belief will go. It does not necessarily make us into those fanatical people. Okay, say that is wrong, that is wrong, that is wrong. The Buddhist way of getting rid of superstition is not like that. It's just that we realize that, okay, you can do it, but I'm not going to do it. You can do it, but I'm not going to do it. If somebody wants, who are interested in listening to us, we tell them, okay, this is superstition, this is not. Let them go back and think for themselves. It's not asking the politicians to make law to forbid this, forbid that, you know, and get rid of superstition. It's just letting people have developed better understanding. You find that in many ways in the scripture, the Buddha did make a lot of people give up their beliefs. Not by condemning the beliefs, but by saying that where this belief will lead them to. There's one case where in the Digha Nikaya, in the longer sayings, when this Brahmin came and see him, and this Brahmins, you know, Brahmins believe that if they are pure by birth, if they are pure birth on the father's side and the mother's side for 7 generations, it makes them very pure. So that Brahmin was trying to tell the Buddha that I'm pure because of my birth. Now that's a belief. Then the Buddha used the argument and says, okay, if you assuming that you are pure on this side and this side for 7 generations, what happens if you kill somebody? Does it make you pure or not? Does it make the Brahmin pure or not? I say, no, it doesn't make the Brahmin pure. Why? Because he's committed a defilement, harm to other people. Then it doesn't make him pure. Then Buddha goes to the next one. He says, if you are pure by this father and mother, and if you start to steal other people's things, does it make the Brahmin pure or not? I say, no. So eventually, the Buddha put these 4 precepts to him. Right? 4 precepts which are already existing in the traditional Indian way. And eventually Buddha told him, now, Brahmin, look, is it because of this more practical thing that you have got a good conduct that makes you pure than to have all this birth that make you pure? See? Then the Brahmin start to think, okay, he says, I accept your way of life. So that's how the Brahmin got rid of this idea about pureness comes with your birth, comes with your genes. So you see, if we are skillful as well, we can tell people, okay, look at it this way, look at it that way. And when we start to do that, we find that not only we can still maintain good relationship with other people. I think if I go to the temple, which I see the woman which tried to stop me from putting the water over the Buddha's head, I still be quite friendly with her. I don't say that not just because you do it, you're bad. I don't go and stand there and tell her, no, from now on everybody should pour the water on the Buddha's head. I don't do that either. It's just because I do it. And she can do it whatever way she wants to. So we are more tolerant. In fact, sometimes it becomes very good. We can join in other people's culture. Although I think there's a lot of superstition and belief in processions and all these things. Yeah? But sometimes I still go on this religious procession, even though they don't belong to my religion. Right? I still enjoy it, just go with the friends. And that, again, when you start to look into that spirit of tolerance, right, it becomes something which is like giving out your kindness without something coming back. Any questions or anything to talk about? Yes?
Yeah, I would like to add something. I came especially for tonight to talk about the title. My life was full of superstition, and so I want to share a little bit of my thoughts, maybe it's useful for you guys, maybe not. I grew up in a very strong Christian community, and I was very much involved in the Christian church and everything. And well, my family had a martial arts and Zen teacher for many years, and somehow I became friends with him, and slowly I slipped into Zen meditation, which was more like well, to learn about myself and my own mind and things like that. But also I was exposed to the Buddhistic values, Buddhistic philosophy, these kind of things, and I started to drift more and more to Buddhism. And a lot of my friends had suspicion, and I said, what are you doing? You're like drifting away to like a sect or some kind of weird weird group. And I said, yeah, I have my own suspicions, and I go very slowly, and I only go as far as I would can verify that it's good for me and that it's right. And so I stayed quite long in the Zen tradition of meditating and seeing the reality and learning about the Eightfold Path. And then when I had different friends, for example Koreans, and they said, you can't do that, and they had this suspicion of political dislike or cultural dislike. And then a couple years later I joined some great Tibetan monks who had been teaching me their way of learning about the reality and how they practice Buddhism, and especially the Tibetan Buddhism, as probably everybody knows, is a very graphic thing. They do a lot of with pictures and things like that, for example, like the skull that you mentioned. So like, I heard some people laughing. Like, I think it's again like maybe not a Christian, a Chinese suspicion against the Tibetans, because they're not a little bit taboo from the political situation and everything else. But their form of Buddhism has a lot of advantages too, especially this graphic way of displaying some kind of wisdom. And I realized a lot of things by looking at some of these pictures. For example, the skull, which is smiling, which could realize a lot of things about that everything is not permanent in the life, that the death will laugh into your face, to your relatives, which will pass away sooner before you, and even you will be like that. And so a lot of things, they set up a lot of very useful ways of teaching. So I think a lot of different Buddhistic traditions, even if they have like silly things like you have to walk around the street three times and things like that, but also each tradition has very interesting and very wise teachers who set up new ways of understanding the truth or the Eightfold Path. I mean, if you look at the Eightfold Path, wisdom, ethic, and things like that, you say, yeah, sure, it makes sense. But actually, to really live that way, you have to understand it on a much deeper level. And a lot of teachers from different traditions set up different ways of approaching this. And so I can only suggest that everybody who grew up in one tradition, look at the other traditions, and maybe you can learn something from them. Even if they do things in a completely other way and you say it is silly, try to find a good teacher, and maybe you can discover something new or a new approach to an old thing that you have overlooked for many, many years. I come from a non-Buddhistic background, so I have the luxury of looking at things without any tradition where I'm used to, so I can really start from scratch and look at what is it all about, and start from the core. So you guys, if you grow up in a Buddhistic background, it is more difficult to be flexible and open your mind to new things. So I can only say like, but I still like the Tibetan tradition a lot. There's a lot of wisdom in there. I mean, for my Chinese friends especially, difficult to approach that.
No, I think there are two things which I want to say about it. You're talking, one word you use very, very interesting is the deeper way you look at things deeply. a lot of things we tend to take superficially. That's what I'm talking about, the superficial thing. Right? When you see a skull, you say, let's skull. Right? A lot of Buddhist teaching is used as metaphors and parables and so on. They tell you things, but there's a story behind it. Right? There's a moral behind every teaching in the thing. Now, in one of the scriptures, the Buddha was telling her, I was born this, and I was up in heaven before, then I came down as a king and so on and so forth. And many times you tell the stories. What he was trying to convince this guy is, this guy placed too much importance on all these things and doesn't understand impermanence. So he was trying to tell her, okay, now it's impermanent. I was now here, now I'm there. So it's impermanence. So if you take it that way, then where is the superstition? But sometimes we do get some of the teachers who say, okay, it must be like that. And it makes the people sometimes lose the wisdom. When you use superstitious things as teachings, if you use the as a morality tale, they are morality stories or talking about parables and metaphors and all these things, and eventually lead them to a right way of thinking, then that is good. But when you are sunk into that particular belief, then it becomes an obstacle. Right? Now, there's one of the Tibetan stories as well, which I think you might know, is this guy going around busy looking for Maitreya. He goes around everywhere. Maitreya is the future Buddha. The present Buddha is here. Teaching is still here, but he still wants to look for the future Buddha. He goes round and round looking for the future Buddha. He goes round the whole country. And every time he thinks Maitreya is Buddha, must be born into some really big temples, big Rinpoche or Lama. So he went there and looked. No, this Rinpoche is not Maitreya. That Rinpoche is not Maitreya. So one day he came back. He was so frustrated. And his stomach said, he says, where are you, Maitreya? I've been looking for you for the last 10 years. Then out of the dog's head came this voice, I'm here. And it's just a little louse or a little tick on the dog's head. Now, there are morals of this story. Right? If you look at it superficially, then it becomes looking for Maitreya, blah, blah. And that's it. But you look at the story behind it, they're trying to tell us something. The present Buddha's teaching is still there, but why are you busy looking, spending your time looking for the future Buddha's teachings? And also, in the teaching of Buddha, every time the Buddha comes, he'll teach the same thing. So if you don't listen to this Buddha and want to try to that Buddha, you're wasting your time. And also, the other moral is, the truth is just so common that it's so plain like a tick on the dog's head. So these are the things, if we can accept the sort of things, okay. But unfortunately, the story, once you start having believers, then it can evolve into all sorts of fantasies. And this, trying to avoid these fantasies will bring us back more into reality. When you start... Looking for?
Can you extend that to enlightenment from
story? Looking for enlightenment is not a fantasy, right? Because we do not know what it is yet. Because we are looking at it as a thing. But enlightenment, if you don't look at it as a thing, it becomes a state. So as you go on there, you say, okay, I've got this glimpse where this present moment, I'm just free of all these emotions and all these things, and that is how I feel. Then you work on it more and more. Then we have glimpses of enlightenment. But unfortunately, enlightenment sometimes, when you start to talk with this, or a lot of this religious philosophy again, it becomes something which is impossible to attain. Right? I mean, there are some who come from some Buddhist, people from Buddhist background who say, that enlightenment is so difficult to attain, you cannot get it in this lifetime. So why bother?
When can you get it?
We don't know. We don't know. Right? So the thing is, we could have got it, but we do not know. Right? It's just like, you know, that future Buddha is down around his dog for years. He doesn't know. Now, what some teachers are telling us is, when you, at the moment when your mind is free from greed, hatred or delusion, that short moment, then that is the state of enlightenment. But because we still are unable to sustain it, right? Therefore we only have a short glimpse of it. So as the practice goes better and better, as wisdom comes up more and more, then at least we can see the enlightenment. We can not see, not attain, but it's something which you get into. and feel okay. When you are not affected by things in this world, that is possibly the state of enlightenment. If you start to look at Nirvana as a place we want to go to, then we look at the wrong place. So once you start to understand it, but unfortunately in the teachings we have got to tell people that it is like that. But when you go on to the practice, it might not be like that. Yes? See, the thing is, I won't answer you directly, but I would answer you in an indirect way, right? When, say you have a team, when I try to compete with you, or in this room, we all try to compete with each other, alright? They end up with one person on top, alright? So the second person, the person who is on the top will be better than the second person below him, right? And the second person below him will be slightly better than the third person below him. So in other words, we are trying to better ourselves to other people. It becomes relative. Right? Now, on the other hand, supposing we look, why not always try to do our level best? Which is better? No. That's why it's impossible. But as long as we look at us, how we do it. See, in competition, if the competition is fair, then there won't be problem. But unfortunately, the competition is not fair either.
Yeah, like you're talking about the cultural and Buddhist.
No, that's, I read in one of the scriptures, the Buddha was trying to, he's telling a story of what he was, I think, yeah, what he was previously, you know, is a story. And the story, he was talking about a lot of things which the corporate world is doing now. Less the greed. Yeah. So, it's possible. Now, the thing is, we got to see. If we put in 100% of the time into that sort of life, then what happens to us? Right? If we put in 50% of the time doing that sort of thing, what happens to us? If we put in 25% of the time in doing that sort of things, what happens to us? Right? So, we can see that if you put in 100%, you'll be 100% stress. If you put in 50%, then at least you are 50% stress. Right? So, it depends very much on us. You see how much stress we want to have. Come to a stage where somebody will say, okay, I do not want to stress myself this way, so I go back to do something else.
My own metaphor is just kind of like a river that you're swimming up trying to get to the top of. You get to be fed a lot, but there are kind of dharma pools that when you've had enough of this competition,
there's a choice. Now look at the most powerful man on earth. It's got all the power in this world. One press of the button, you can have a nuclear warfare, right? But is he really calm or happy? Or not? He might look nice and all these things in front, right? But he's really happy, he's really free of fear, then he wouldn't have so many bodyguards guarding him everywhere he goes to. Right? So that is the thing which, you know. Look at the ordinary common monk. Right? He's got no car, nothing much. Right? He might own a few dollars in the bank. He might have only 3 ropes. His meal got to depend on the meal supply by people. Is he happy or not? Yeah. So it depends on the state of mind. Eh? So now, if we are physically in that condition, naturally our state of mind, if we are not, we cannot control the mind, or we cannot grab that properly, then we are gripped by fear. Now for most of us, that's one guy who, when he's got nothing, yeah, he just goes around, you know, going to eat in the shop, whatever he likes. When he starts to go up level in the country, which is quite dangerous, right? You find that eventually his son has got to have 2 bodyguards to go and so on, and he's got to have 2 or 3 bodyguards. So it's up to the person to have a choice. We tend to look at things in a, as you say, the capitalistic way. To say that we must have wealth. If wealth is what the Buddha says, wealth is just wealth. It's how you treat it. If you have wealth as your nothing else but wealth, then you got to take everything that comes with the wealth. The good and the bad that comes with it. So what's the other thing? The Buddha could have got a lot of wealth, but he gave up. And he just goes wandering around. So that is an example for us to follow. But I would say for most of us, we've got to follow somewhere in between. Because it's no point in saying, oh, I want to become a good Buddhist, so shave the head off and go to a monastery. It's not the most important part of Buddhism either. So we've got to know that there's got to be a good balance of our life. If you're going to be in the world where you say you're going to work in a corporate place, okay, see how much you're going to spend in it. Any other questions?
You mentioned a lot about people going to pray and all this, but what about some people who actually get some inspiration and sometimes they'll feel tired, there's a lot of stress in life and all this, but sometimes, when they go to these places, they look for aspiration, inspiration, and motivation to move on or whatever. What do you say about it?
Well, if they do it this way, it's better than thinking that the Buddha will take away the stress. That's why we always go and ask for blessings and gifts from somewhere else. If you go, I'm not against prayers like that. When you go, I really enjoy doing the best prayers I have is a full 1.5 hour Chinese prayers. Right? Even though I talk so much against it. Right? But I think going up and down, bending, bowing and all these things, to me, it's not that I'm going to bow and then I can five marks here and 10 points there, to get the aggregate and all these things. I just go there and I feel that, okay, I'm so relaxed doing that. When people chant, you actually get that relaxation. But don't take that as the main practice. A lot of people will say, you don't chant, you don't get the merits, then it's wrong again. You go there, you just do it and just be with it. And prayer sometimes will allow you to be at the present moment. I remember this, in our custom, the old ladies used to pray. They go there, they wave their incense, and they keep on mumbling all the miseries and everything, right? Misery, and then I hope that you come. Now, this is a very good psychological way, because they get it out of the chest. But does it make them really happy for a long time or not? What, after prayers, you go home there, see the daughter-in-law doing something, oh, there you are, stupid daughter-in-law. So you've got to look at, that's why I said from the very beginning, some of these superstitions are not really, do not cause serious problems. But some of them do actually cause a lot of problems. There are cases where people refuse to send the children or sick people to see a doctor, see a hospital, and they prefer to do that to pray. And that actually caused problems. The Buddha did not say that all prayers work. He would say that meditation works. But meditation does not take away our sickness. It allows you to deal better with your sickness. Meditation does not take away your suffering, but it makes you better to deal with your suffering. If you take it that way, then it's all right. It's good. But you start to say that, if I go to to give donations to the temple, then I might pass my exams, you know, better than my competitor, then something is wrong with your thinking. Sometimes can still be superstition, but it's not so serious anymore. When you go and pray, okay, at least, you know, if you are superstitious, then when you put incense on, the mindset is very different. The grabbing, the attachment is there. But when you are doing it with a better understanding, the attachment is less. When you say, I give this incense, not because I want that particular Buddha or Bodhisattva to give me blessings, then it's a lot better. You go there, you do out of respect. And that's the way of doing it. People shake hands, people do hands like that, people do hands like that. So it's a form of greetings, a form of respect. Then once you understand that, then where is that belief coming in?
It's a little part of it as well, as a cultural identity. If we are too critical of our own cultural practice, our own religious practice, and talk down of our own traditional practice, then it can be used by other people
to
attack us, which doesn't help us to sustain the Buddhist teaching.
Yeah. What you do is, you're talking not to say, yeah, taking away the superstition in the thing, not taking away the culture. Now, there's a case where it happened in Penang, where one of my friends, my mother's friends, she came into this meditation type of Buddhism. Again, she took it too gung-ho, right? Very strong on that, meditating, and then nothing else. So everything else is wrong. So one day she came home, decided, you know, in the Chinese family, they call all these altars. So took away all those things and burned them. And then when the mother came back and all the gods are all gone, the mother was crying away. I don't know, we shouldn't cry, all this are superstitious. That is going too far. All you got to do is don't go to the stage. Now when you say, okay, I don't believe in these sort of things, but when somebody invites you to the service, when they burn a lot of paper money and all this, just sit there and just enjoy with them. Right? Now don't say that, okay, I want to contribute burning the paper money and so that I can get another 20,000 in my accounts later on. So that's a mindset you have. You can still go and eat with them. Supposing, you know, a lot of people there's one or two of people who became very vegetarian in the thing. Right? And then when they go back, you know, a lot of Buddhists, when they do dana, they don't give vegetarian food. So they go there and say, I'm vegetarian, I'm not gonna eat your food. Now again, there's attachment. So when they do that, just be there. Just rejoice with people, as we call it. But you go to a vegetarian thing, don't say that I don't eat vegetarian food. Go and rejoice with them and eat. If a vegetarian, when they see them, they don't give non-vegetarian, eat with them too, rejoice with them. But after all, you know, all these things, a lot of things we hold very strongly, attachment is because of our belief. And the other one, again, a superstitious belief that, you know, when you're vegetarian, you will be very good and then go to Western heaven next time. Again, this is the belief. Doesn't take, it's not the thing which you practice, superficial things. Like the Buddha said, it's not because of the birth, therefore you're pure. It's not because of all these rituals, therefore you get enlightened. It's more your understanding of the mind. Go back to your way, it's the understanding of it. Right? So when you start to understand it, then the rituals can be done without that really attaching to the rituals. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, everyone. Just before we end off, we'll always have a couple of announcements. Tomorrow, we actually have a meditation workshop, and the topic is Introduction to Meditation. It's from 10 to 1, and it's at Square House, room 203. That's level 2 of Square House. And if you have any questions, you can always contact Mei Ling. This is a contact number. So as Jim mentioned, you know, learning meditation and practicing that enables us to strengthen our mind and to deal with our lives better. So come to meditation workshop tomorrow. It will be beneficial. The speaker for tomorrow is actually Rod Lee. I'm not sure if you guys have heard of him before, but he's a very good meditator and very good practitioner. He's a very good teacher as well. So do come along. I've been to a couple of his meditations. It's very beneficial. Also, this Sunday we have a badminton session. It's from 11 to 1 and it's at Uni Gym at the Multipurpose Hall. Any queries, we can always contact Rosianna. That's her contact number. Lunchtime meditation, as usual, every Monday, 1:15 to 2 at Square House Level 3, Room 311. That's our Unibus Library. Again, contact mainly. Chinese Dharma Talk, the topic is actually practices and suttas in Buddhism. And the speaker will be Venerable Ningrong. As usual, it'll be on Thursday, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. And contact Bernard if you have any questions. Contact number is there. And as usual, if you're particularly interested in any Mandarin, Chinese talk, and you feel that you won't be able to understand, if you're really keen on it, just give us a ring. We'll try to arrange someone to be there to translate for you. Okay. And next week, although it's Good Friday, it's a public holiday, is it? Okay. But we still have English Dharma talk. Okay. And actually, we're very lucky to have Bante Sujato next week. He's actually a Western monk, and he's been practicing Buddhism for a very long time. And he's actually from the Theravada tradition. And the topic next week is gratitude in six directions. So, in case you're wondering what the six directions are, so come along next Friday. So it's a public holiday. There's nothing much going on, you know. So it's good to come and enjoy a Dharma talk next Friday. Okay, so if you have any questions at all about English Dharma talks, just ask me. I'll be around. Okay, and as usual, we'll pay respects to the Buddha after we finish. So may I just invite everyone to stand up, please?
Thank you.